Hey there, this is Laura Kanoi.
Shh.
What? I mean, what?
Loretta Allison here. We're having a secret drive.
Oh, so that means...
Shh.
Oh, got it. If you love the exchange, consider a small donation to the station that makes it.
Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in, and we'll send you some secret swag.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope you'll make some noise for the exchange.
This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Support for The Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. It's graduation season, with commencement exercises marking the end of the school year. While at the New Hampshire State House, the legislature is wrapping up its session, and 8 senators have announced they won't be returning. That means 1/4 of the Senate will be new faces in 2017, with implications for the balance of power there. WMUR's John DeStazo, a veteran political journalist, commented on the turnover.
So if you have a new governor and you have a new Senate, whether it's Republican or Democrat, there's going to be a shakeup. It's going to be a different year starting in 2017.
And at the State House this week, New Hampshire became the first state to launch an initiative to promote awareness of the signs of mental illness and eliminate stigma around it. Barbara Van Dalen, a psychologist and founder of the national campaign Change Direction, underlined how very common mental illness is.
Yesterday in the chamber, I asked, as I regularly do when I speak, if there's anyone in this chamber who has not been touched by a mental health challenge, concern, or issue, raise your hand. Nobody did. No one ever does.
Meanwhile, mental health issues were involved in the shootings of 2 police officers 2 weeks ago in Manchester and apparently earlier this week in a fatal shooting in Londonderry. At the same time, there's developing concern about staffing at New Hampshire Hospital, a central component of the state's mental health system. A contract dispute between Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and the hospital's psychiatric team has called into question just who will provide care there after July 1st. Ken Norton, executive director of NAMI New Hampshire, says it's a very real deadline.
To have that essential piece of our safety net, you know, sort of up in the air, it's a little bit scary.
It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Kathleen Ronayne, New Hampshire State House and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Kathleen, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you too, Laura.
Also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Gary, thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thanks for being here as always.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, all of you, mental health seemed to top the headlines this week. And since we have 2 State House reporters here, let's start with that huge bipartisan crowd that turned out for a new mental health awareness initiative called Change Direction. Gary, what's this campaign all about?
Well, it's about trying to change people's attitude about mental illness and how you approach it and being able to openly talk about it more than that, because it seems to be the issue that everybody just sort of puts aside and doesn't really want to talk about. I mean, we had former Chief Justice John Broderick leading the charge, basically, and he's had some very well-known problems with his son who attacked him with a guitar at one point and ended up going to the state prison where they found particularly medication that addressed his issue. And at the time, John Broderick and his wife said, "We've really failed our son." And so that's what he was telling to people here. We didn't know the the symptoms. We didn't know what was going on. We really need to be much more aware of what of the symptoms and how we can help people.
Well, we played that clip just a second ago of the national leader of this, Barbara Van Dalen. But you're right, Justice Broderick is sort of the New Hampshire face of this campaign. We talked to Justice Broderick about this issue on The Exchange earlier this week on this idea that he feels like, as you said, Gary, he failed his son. Let's hear what John Broderick said about that.
What I would love to see happen today, and I know then it would be working, is that parents like I am and was back then would know the basic signs, be able to say to their children at appropriate ages, look, just let mom and dad know if you have any of these feelings or experiences, not a deficiency in you, but we need to talk about it. And there's plenty of medical assistance available. You may never feel that. Or maybe just social angst that all kids have at a certain age. But in my son's case, it was very different. And had he told me that, Laura, I would have known that even back then, this isn't normal, and we should get him some help. So we need to talk about it.
Again, that's John Broderick, co-chair of the new Change Direction NH initiative. There was a big kickoff at the State House this week, and Justice Broderick was on The Exchange this week also talking about this. Kathleen, many people were struck by the size of the crowd at the State House, and who was in that crowd?
Yeah, I think that Representatives Hall, where they held it, was almost entirely full with people who showed up for this. And it, as we've seen in New Hampshire over, you know, the past several years, it is a bipartisan issue. Gene Shaheen was there, Annie Custer, Frank Ginta. I think Kelly Ayotte had planned to be there, but something came up and she was unable to make it. Frank Ginta, Republican congressman, has also been pretty open about having a family member who struggles with mental illness. And I believe that he spoke about that at the campaign kickoff. So I think that they're trying to draw a lot of attention to it by getting well-known New Hampshire faces, by showing that this is an issue that crosses party lines. We've talked a lot about mental health in New Hampshire over the past maybe 3 to 4 years, specifically, you know, with the lawsuit over our mental health care system. So it's an issue that has been on people's radar, and I think they're trying to expand it now beyond, you know, just a conversation about the State House and about our mental health infrastructure to, you know, getting citizens, New Hampshire residents, everybody kind of talking about how we identify these signs, how to know when someone might be struggling with mental illness or mental health issues, and how to get them the help that they need.
Well, and there were several disturbing headlines about mental health this week in the state, along with the celebration of this campaign kicking off. A different story at New Hampshire Hospital this week, Dean, where a staff dispute over a contract has a lot of people worried about the state's key mental health safety net. This is an important story. It was covered in depth by NHPR's Jack Rodolico this week. Just remind us first, Dean, please, what role New Hampshire Hospital plays in this mental health system. It's often called, again, you know, a central component.
Right. The state hospital, it's essentially the sort of main state-run facility for people who need help with mental health challenges and illness. And, you know, this particular problem is occurring just at a time where the focus has been on trying to actually expand the ability to take in people so that they don't have to wait in emergency rooms until a bed opens up. You know, there's supposed to be an additional wing open with more beds. And the genesis of this problem is that the state has traditionally contracted with Geisel Medical School up at Dartmouth College to provide a group or a team, a clinical team of doctors, nurses, and staff.
I see. That's the connection. I was wondering what the connection was between the
right.
Geisel School of Medicine
right.
and
so they've traditionally
the
provided
state hospital.
Under contract, they've traditionally provided a team of mental health professionals to the state hospital. Geisel in recent years has been struggling with some budgetary problems and running deficits. And we talked about this on the roundup a few weeks ago. They announced a big transferring a number of functions from the medical school to Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, which is sort of a separate nonprofit entity, even though there's a relationship with the medical school. And there were some layoffs and staff being transferred from one entity to the other. So this is where the problem came in, because this particular clinical team that had been under contract by the medical school, was waiting to see sort of their new contract from Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, which would now be providing the team to the state. They were unhappy with the contract. They want to kind of form their own sort of unit and then negotiate that way. So basically, there's a little bit of a standoff here because they're not happy with the contract being provided by DHMC. And so the concern is that the state has to sort of put out the bid to hire this team. And right now, there really isn't anybody to fulfill the need.
Wow. And June 1st is the end of the fiscal year. So what happens on July 1? Kathleen, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think that a handful of the psychiatrists that were already working at New Hampshire Hospital have, you know, accepted the contract with Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. But I think, you know, anytime the state puts a contract out to bid, you know, there's potential for these types of issues. But what's interesting here is it seems like there was an assumption that these psychiatrists would just move over and everything would be fine. And I don't know that it was really evaluated and vetted properly, you know, when they were looking at the contract. And I mean, this is really the place in the state where you go if you are having a psychiatric emergency. And these doctors that worked under contract with Dartmouth College, is my understanding, they are the only, you know, providers at New Hampshire Hospital. It's not like the state, I mean, this is who the state hires to run this. So if July 1st rolls around and we have these people that aren't working there, it could be, I mean, obviously be a concern. Ken Norton has
expressed
that.
And it sounds like they wanted to stay. They just were not happy with the alternative contract from DHMC and compared to what they were previously getting from the guys.
Right. And I don't know the details. I don't know if anyone else says, I don't know the details particularly of, you know, what in the contract they were unhappy with. But, you know, this dispute has been – it's been going on for at least weeks, I think longer, and they've been unable to solve it. And so we're starting to see it come into the public eye a little bit more.
Right.
But
wow, Gary.
The state's kind of in a bind here because they put out an RFP knowing that this contract –
Request for proposals.
Knowing this contract with Cassell was going to is coming to an end at June 30th, and the only entity that bid on it was Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. So now they've awarded it to them, and now
they have no team to
put there, and people are saying you can't put together a team like this, so they're in kind of a bind.
Well, what a mess. And Gary, you know, improvements at New Hampshire Hospital were part of the state's mental health settlement, right? That it's supposed to be meeting under a lawsuit, under an agreement.
Mm-hmm.
So what does this mean for that effort?
Well, one of the things that they were doing, part of that effort, was the 10-bed unit that they're trying to open. But and here we go again. One of the problems that they've had opening the unit is finding people to staff it. And here we have the same issue coming back with the people at the hospital now.
Well, in emergency rooms, Kathleen, right? Part of the lawsuit was, or emergency rooms said, yeah, people are hanging out too long at, you know, Lakes Region General or Concord Hospital or Elliott or wherever. And, you know, state of New Hampshire, you need to do something about this. You need to expand New Hampshire Hospital so these people who are suffering have a place to go.
Yeah, that's something we hear, you know, over and over again whenever stories about people facing mental health challenges make their way into the news. You hear the complaint that there aren't enough beds. I mean, we heard this in the shooting of the two Manchester police officers, the accused shooter. You know, his father was saying that he had tried to get his son into New Hampshire Hospital. There weren't enough beds. I mean, I don't have a paper trail to back that up, but you know, that is what he's saying. We hear that kind of again and again, people saying that they're looking for beds, they can't find them. So it's, you know, been an ongoing challenge for New Hampshire, obviously. Money always plays a role in New Hampshire, setting up the infrastructure. Nationally, there's a shortage of people to do this type of work because of the pay and, a variety of other things. So I think that it's definitely all kind of – we have a lot of pieces of the mental health puzzle that are kind of all coming into play over the past few weeks.
Yeah, you're right, Kathleen. In those shootings in Manchester, luckily the police officers were not – killed, but this week a Londonderry man was killed by someone who apparently had some mental health challenges. And I say apparently because there's a lot we don't know yet. But Dean Spiliotis, you know, this man was just doing his job, filling up the guy's fuel oil tank at his house. And then all of a sudden the guy comes out and shoots him. He was just doing what he's supposed to do, showing up for work. How much does this incident and the shootings of the Manchester police officers that Kathleen mentioned affect the conversation around mental health and the services here in New Hampshire?
Well, I think it certainly does. And I think part of what you're seeing going on here is kind of a larger, somewhat gradual, but certainly changing notion or awareness of mental health issues in the state. I just think sort of culturally people are a lot more open about it. There's a greater attempt to kind of, as we discussed just a few minutes ago, notice the signs and symptoms earlier. With this particular homeowner who shot the worker and then shot himself, I saw on Twitter when he moved into the neighborhood, he gave all his neighbors this very sort of unusual letter about who he was and you know, people were out to get him. So, you know, you see those kind of things and you just sort of figure, okay, well, that's his business. I'll just kind of go about my own business. And, you know, there's always a little bit of hindsight. So I think it is changing the conversation. It's increasingly common now when you hear these stories. You know, we talked about that car chase that went on for an hour a week or so ago through Massachusetts and New Hampshire. That individual family say he had mental health problems. So it's increasingly becoming part of the story as there's a greater awareness and less of a stigma associated with talking about this.
Again, the exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. And join us as we cover some of the top headlines around the Granite State of the past week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. So Gary asked Dean how these incidents that keep happening are changing the conversation around mental health care in the Granite State. What about the conversation, Gary, that you've been covering at the State House around who should have a gun and who shouldn't? How are these recent incidents where people who seem to have, you know, pretty severe mental health challenges lash out, hurt someone, kill someone? Go ahead. I'd love to hear what you're hearing among lawmakers.
Well, I think lawmakers have been discussing this for a couple of years now, basically going back to the incident in Connecticut at Sandy Brook. We've been having several bills after the other, actually, because New Hampshire is one of the few states that doesn't put people who have mental illness or mental illness issues into the national database for people who purchase guns. And
that's not part of the background check then?
It's not part of the – well, the information from New Hampshire isn't. I mean, it is part of the background check for most everybody else, but New Hampshire doesn't put that information in there. Most other states do. In fact – a lot of states didn't, but after the incident in Connecticut, a lot more states started doing that. And the irony is that this person who shot the two police officers, I mean, he's still under the law, under the federal guidelines, wouldn't have been barred from having a gun. So, I mean, it's kind of a real complicated, sticky issue.
Kathleen.
Yeah, the federal standard for being barred from buying a gun based on mental health issues is pretty high. It has to rise to a pretty extreme level. You have to be either deemed by a judge that you are not competent to stand trial, or you have to be involuntarily committed to a mental health hospital or a mental health institution. So there are going to be a lot of people that are going to go through a variety of mental health challenges that are never going to rise to that level. And federal law does not prohibit them from buying a gun. And, you know, I think there's a real question over, you know, should federal law prohibit them from buying a gun? You talk to, you know, someone, Ken Norton at NAMI says, you know, we can't just have these broad brushes to say that anytime you might face a mental health challenge, you're inherently dangerous and you can't have a gun. So, it's definitely a complex issue. And I think because these incidents happened, you know, at the end of the legislative session, we're not, you know, lawmakers haven't really been forced to to grapple with it legislatively. We asked the governor some questions about it last week, and she says that she supports putting our records in the background check system, but wasn't specific if she supported any other changes. So I think it's a question about, one, you know, what should our standards be, but also how do we get people the help that they need before it rises to that level of, you know, committing a dangerous act. And also the folks at NAMI are saying, you know, it's really important to not link dangerousness with mental health, you know, to not put that broad brush right. to say that just because someone has a mental health challenge that they are dangerous, because in a lot of times that's not the case. And I think, you know, the majority of gun crimes are not committed by somebody with a mental health issue. So it's really, really complex. And in New Hampshire, we know anytime you start to talk about guns and who can and can't have a gun, things get really emotionally charged. So I don't know. I mean, there's 6 months between now and the start of the next legislative session. So whether or not this issue will still be in the spotlight, we'll have to see.
Well, and there'll be a lot of new faces at the State House in 2017, as we'll talk about after a short break. And we'll continue with a couple more threads on this topic as well. Also, I want to ask all of you after a short break about the Site Evaluation Committee announcing it's going to extend the review process of the Northern Pass Project till the almost the end of 2017. So that was a big story this week as well. All that's coming up, plus your questions and comments. Stay with us for the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. In a moment, why Granite State Republicans are worried about holding onto the state Senate and how the national GOP is considering, get ready, combining New Hampshire's first in the nation primary with Massachusetts. We will talk about that in a couple minutes. You can join us, as always, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Kathleen Ronayne, Gary Reno, Dean Spiliotis, just before the break, we were finishing up our conversation about, you know, real concern about the mental health system here in New Hampshire. And Dean, I could see that you want to jump in there. Go ahead.
Yeah, just one comment. I mean, first of all, I think Kathleen's comments on raise again this issue of stigma and the concern that, you know, immediately connecting having some sort of mental illness and whether or not you're dangerous, people find that problematic. But what's interesting here is there's another whole political dimension to this, because conservatives have found it very useful to recast the whole gun issue as a mental health issue, because it takes the focus off of whether or not you possess guns, makes it all about mental health, puts Democrats in a bind because they want to focus on the actual issue of guns and the types of guns and how many guns and all of that sort of stuff. But at the same time, they don't want to be seen as kind of being anti-mental health. So there's been this sort of very interesting shift, and, you know, conservatives and are very happy to talk about kind of mental health issues and gun rights, although it does run into some privacy issues as well. But that I've noticed that shift in recent years.
Well, here's a Facebook comment from Holly, who says, perhaps it's time for the state of New Hampshire to become directly and immediately involved with this situation, meaning the staffing dispute at the state hospital that we talked about earlier. Holly says it's hard to believe that Kakavas has the well-being of patients as his number one priority. So, Gary, just a little background. So Kakavas is who that Holly is referring to?
John Kakavas was an assistant attorney general for a while. And then he was the U.S. attorney just until about a year ago when he stepped down. And now he's the attorney at the Dartmouth-Hitchcock
in this
medical
dispute between the state hospital.
He thinks he's general counsel, so he's sort of the lead counsel for the medical center.
So here's a question. Holly says perhaps it's time for the state of New Hampshire to become directly and immediately involved. Right now, as you all explained, the state contracts out with Dartmouth for these psychiatrists. I mean, Gary, could they just hire psychiatrists as state employees and, you know, be done with it that way?
Well, that's a little tricky because of the state employee contract. You have certain pay levels and so on, and I'm sure these aren't high enough to attract the people that you need to attract. That's one of the reasons that we have the contract with the medical school. I mean, they were about to lose their accreditation about 20 years ago, and they turned to the Dartmouth. It's, you know, it's one of those things where out of the worst situations, you get innovation, and that's what we had.
This idea of contracting
with the medical school and bringing these top-notch psychiatrists here.
It's been a long legislative season, Gary. I appreciate that.
And, you know, some of these students to come in and work with them and so on. So it worked out very well, and now we're in the middle of another mess here. So
I see. All right. Well,
but that's how we got here in the first place, was the state couldn't really go out and find the people that they need.
Holly, thank you for the Facebook comment. And let's go to the phones. Nancy is calling from Westmoreland. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I've never been on the exchange before.
Well, welcome, Nancy. Go ahead.
This is a subject that I feel strongly about because I have a husband that is bipolar and has been for a long time and functions very well, but occasionally he has difficulties really with his medicine. And we just went through a period of being addicted to Klonopin that was put on him by a psychiatrist. And he was in severe withdrawal from that. And I tried to find help for him. And it was, I went everywhere.
Well, and you're in a pretty rural area there, Nancy, too. So that
might be even more difficult. And they closed the mental health unit at the Cheshire Medical Center. But I called Vermont. I called Massachusetts. I called the retreat in Brattleboro.
Sure, Brattleboro retreat. Nancy, thank you for the call. And I'm sorry to hear about your situation. And Dean, it just kind of highlights that it's kind of what we hear about drug treatment as well. People want mental health treatment. They're seeking it, and they can't find it.
Yeah, and or they can't find it in a way that they can afford.
Right.
Part of the issue is it can be, you know, seeing a psychiatrist paying out of your pocket can run hundreds of dollars. People don't have that, so they look to either state offices or state-offered options or clinics, and there just aren't as many any options. So it's just very, you know, there's a whole issue about, you know, healthcare and whether or not health insurance should pay for more of this kind of treatment. But they're just on a basic level. We've talked about this in terms of opioid addiction. There aren't enough sort of places and clinics that people can go to get help that they can afford.
Gary, real quick.
Yeah, I think this is, I mean, it's kind of tied in here. The focus right now is on drug addiction and what we can do to do that. And it seems as though the focus has come off of the mental health side of that a little bit, which is why we're having some of the problems we're having, I think.
Even though there is this settlement.
You know, all the money that the state has, which we always have this. It's a battle wherever you are. You know, where's the money going to go? Well, the money right now is headed into the drug treatment instead of other things.
And Nancy, good luck again. And I'm glad that you called in to share your story today. I did want to turn to a major story, made my eyebrows go up, all of you, concerning energy policy this week. The Site Evaluation Committee, Kathleen, announced it would extend its review process of the Northern Pass project until September of 2017. First of all, just remind us, please, Kathleen, what is the Site Evaluation Committee? Why is it so important?
Yeah, so the Site Evaluation Committee is a state-level entity that deals with siting energy projects. So I believe, and one of these guys can correct me if I'm wrong, that Northern Pass needs a go-ahead from the Site Evaluation Committee before it can get going. And so this is just, you know, yet another twist in the long saga that is Northern Pass. And will this project get approved, and will it not get approved? And now we've got, you know, almost a year and a half until we're going to find out. We heard the Business and Industry Association, which is our statewide chamber of commerce, and the IBEW, which is a labor union, both came out and they were pretty upset about this delay. And, you know, the BIA said that they were hoping the SEC was not going to succumb to opponents who wanted to continually delay this process. The IBEW obviously is upset about it because they want the project, because they want the jobs. And the BIA has, you know, advocated for large-scale energy projects that can, they hope, reduce costs.
Sure.
So, you know, it's Northern Pass is kind of never ending, right? And it's going to be a long time. And I think the BIA was, or you know, there were also complaints that, okay, once we get to 2017, that means it's going to be at least 2020 or 2021 until this project gets online. And I think it was first proposed in 2011. So it's been a long time on this debate about Northern Pass. And I don't personally know. You know, I was not at the SEC meetings on this, so I don't know what specifically they're looking for. You would think that pretty much what's known, what needs to be known, is probably known at this point. But they're, you know, I think they said that they don't have enough time to review everything. And
lots
I think the consumer advocate also said that there's not enough time for them to review everything. So they feel, you know, they need more to go through all of the various, you know, documents, arguments, all these different things that they have.
Were you surprised, Dean? 2017, fall of 2017 seems like a long way away.
No, I was not surprised. We've been talking about this for a couple of years now, and that's how opponents typically grind down these kinds of projects over time. And I think, you know, to some extent, I think people who oppose these kinds of big projects were emboldened by the canceling of the Kinder Morgan pipeline that we've talked about a lot. We haven't even gotten totally into the sort of the legal lawsuit aspect of this, which could drag it on even further. I remember talking about this a couple years ago and thinking that the original start date was supposed to be like 2017 or 2018, and thinking that was
for flipping the switch.
Yeah, that was very optimistic, and now we're at 2020. You know, you and I may be retired by the time this thing. Gary will certainly be retired, but you and I may be. Kathleen will still be out there covering it for us, but the rest of us may be retired by the time this. I mean, it's a huge project. It's very complicated, and as a result of that, there are lots of different entry points for people who oppose this, and this kind of a delay is one way to do it.
Again, our phone number for you to join us on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in the exchange on NHPR. Let's hear from you as we cover some of the big headlines from around the Granite State this week. Our guests are Kathleen Ronay, New Hampshire State House and politics reporter for the Associated Press, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And I want to turn to our team of State House reporters now, Kathleen and Gary. So what is happening at the legislature right now, Kathleen? Are they almost done? Are they packing their bags for summer vacation? Or are they still hanging out?
They're almost done. They're almost done. So this week was committees of conference, where that's when the House and Senate have both passed the same bill but different versions of it. And so they have to make these 7-member negotiating teams to try and work out their differences. So they were doing that this week. They did finish that work yesterday. Yesterday at 4 was the deadline for them to sign off on their reports. So now what happens is these deals that they cut next week will go back to the House and Senate for a final vote.
So this means these are the issues where we think we can reach agreement, reach a bill, and send it to the governor? Is that right, Kathleen?
Yeah. So what happens oftentimes is a bill will go through. So we'll take the gay conversion therapy bill, for example. That was a ban on the practice for minors. Went through the House, passed the House, went to the Senate. The Senate amended it. And so and the House didn't agree to the amendment. So they have to meet in a negotiating committee to say, okay, we both passed this bill, but we need to try and work out our differences here. And that is an example of a bill that died in committee of conference. They couldn't come to agreement, so they killed it. That's not going to be going to the governor's desk. In other cases on, bill on taxing Airbnb businesses. They have slightly different versions of it. They meet in committee of conference. They work out the differences. They come up with a deal. And if the House and Senate, pass the deal, then it goes to the governor's desk. So this is usually, committee of conference is a pretty unpredictable week. You never know what's going to happen. Like, for example, with the gay conversion therapy bill, it passed both chambers. There seemed to be agreement, but ultimately, at the last minute, the leadership or whatever decided that, this wasn't a bill that they wanted to pass, so it didn't get through the committee. So next week, though, is when they're going to wrap up most of what they have to do.
Gary, I have a quick question for you, too. But that bill that you mentioned, the conversion therapy, this was a bill, Kathleen, right, to ban this practice.
For minors, yeah.
Yeah.
So it would be – what it would have done is anyone who is licensed under certain state statutes to provide counseling, so it could be a nurse, a marriage counselor, anyone like that, they can't engage in the counseling practice of attempting to change somebody's sexuality or gender identity. The argument is that this has been proven to be a very damaging type of, quote-unquote therapy to go through for young people. The rates of, suicide for LGBT youth are already much higher than their non-LGBT peers. And there was a lot of, concern that this is something that's really dangerous and damaging.
So a couple states have passed this. New Hampshire would have been, I think, the 5th or 6th mm-hmm. state. Governor Hassan said this week she was disappointed that this conversion therapy ban bill did not make it to her desk. Let's hear.
We know that conversion therapy is a bad practice that harms our young people. And the last thing we want to do is convey to our young people that we feel that there's something wrong with who they are.
So that's one bill that didn't make it to the governor's desk. What else was decided, Gary, at the legislature this week in terms of this sort of final stage that Kathleen described?
Well, we had an awful lot of bills that went through. We had some of them were very, they've been hanging around for a long time. We also had medical marijuana. not medical marijuana, decriminalization of marijuana, which ended up being basically what the Senate proposed originally, which is just lowering from Class A misdemeanor to an unspecified misdemeanor.
Softening the penalties a little
softening
bit.
What it really does is it gives prosecutors and judges more discretion to not really hand out large sentences. Business tax bills, we had the two big business tax bills, came to an agreement on both of those.
So all those that you mentioned, Gary, are going to Governor Hanson?
Going to the governor. She's agreed to those two bills. One, which is, quote unquote, the Planet Fitness bill, which is over these initial public offerings, if you will, and how the state taxes them, because we don't have a capital gains tax, which is the way most states tax that. We tax the thing as though it was business profit when there's this infusion of money, or it's called a step up. And this bill would sort of do away with that. You could either pay the tax or you could take the depreciation, but you can't do both. And it sort of solves that problem a little bit. The other thing we did, we had some final conclusions on about three of the other big drug bills that we had
regarding opioid abuse.
Two of them made it through. One of them was killed, which was the smallest one, which is $56,000 for the program that ran out of Plymouth State College. That one didn't make it through, but we had the main one, which was the Senate Bill 533, which provides about $5 million for treatment and recovery housing, peer-to-peer recovery programs, and also a new attorney general. So, I mean, those all got through. What else? Drones didn't make it. Drones crashed and burned. And those are the, I think, that's pretty much the major ones.
Well, it's radio. Listeners can't see, but I want to let everybody know Gary has a very long list there of all the bills that he was tracking as the legislature starts to wrap up. Kathleen, go ahead.
Yeah, just on the drug bills, of interest would be there was a dispute over, you know, whether or not we should fund with general fund dollars about $130,000 for a drug prosecutor in the AG's office. And they did approve that position, but the AG's office can only hire someone if he can find grants or other money. So it's not general fund dollars. And that is, I mean, it seems small, but I think that's particularly interesting because, you know, Joe Foster, the attorney general, his office, they are starting to make a much more concerted push to prosecute drug dealers under not exactly charges of murder, but, you know, a death resulting charge, which is you link the dealer to the overdose death. And I was talking to him earlier this week, and he was saying that, you know, the county attorney's offices are very bombarded with, you know, new cases that they're trying to bring in. They're referring a lot of cases to the AG's office, and the AG's office hasn't even done a formal training yet for police about how to look at these overdoses as crime scenes. So they're expecting to get a lot more cases that they have to investigate. You know, that's why they – part of why they want a new prosecutor, and, you know, they said they'll be able to do it without one, but they'd like to have another. Obviously, you know, legislature lawmakers are always a little bit skeptical of, okay, we funded you some new positions already in the budget. Why do you need more? You should have the resources to do what you need to do. But – so they – I mean, they approved this position, but they didn't actually appropriate any money towards it. So we'll see what actually happens with that.
Joan, jump in, Dean.
Yeah, interesting. I want to go back to the drone bill that Gary was talking about, because this is fascinating that it was sort of a conflict between kind of business incentives and privacy rights. This would have regulated the use of drones over, you know, private and governmental use of drones. As I understand it, there was an exception for businesses put in there, and that's really what – that's privacy advocates didn't like that, and that essentially tanked it, which I thought was kind of an interesting trade-off.
The prime sponsor of the bill is Neil Kirk, and Neil Kirk is like the legislator's biggest privacy advocate, and he was just livid that this was even – the businesses would have this exception, and so he said – it's not worth it. Let's kill the bill.
Yeah, one of the legislators had a great comment about not wanting a drone to come in, take a picture of his furniture from Lowe's, and then have Lowe's tell him it's time for new furniture. That was very clever.
All right. Well, we didn't get to this next story concerning the legislature, but we will do it after a break because it's real interesting. Lots and lots of new faces in the state Senate next year. Two more Republican senators this week said they won't run for re-election. So now we've got six Republicans and two Democrats not running. So a bunch of open seats there. We'll talk about what that might mean for state politics. And we'll hear from you. Join us at 1-800-892-6477. More weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a moment. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join us as we catch up on some of the top Granite State headlines of the week. 1-800-892-6477. So all of you, let's talk about the New Hampshire State Senate for just a moment. And Dean, just remind us, lots of new faces there next year.
Yeah, we have eight senators now who won't be running for re-election. Some are moving on to either take other positions or run for other offices, like Jeannie Forrester is running for governor, Russell Prescott's running for executive counsel, Jerry Little's going to banking commissioner. But there are other retirements as well. You know, people ask, is this unusual? Well, in 2012, eight people left, and in 2014, four people left. So it's not totally unusual, but there, you know, there could potentially be some more individuals. It's six Republicans and two Democrats?
Six and two.
Yeah. And there's some belief among Democrats that some of those seats will be in play, which might give them a chance to get the Senate back.
Gary?
What I think is interesting, it's not so much, I mean, there are six Republicans and two Democrats. Two Democratic seats are probably safe. They're big Democratic districts.
One's in Keene. Where's
one's
the other
in
one?
Keene, the other is the Upper Valley.
Okay.
But the six Republicans, it's interesting who's leaving. I mean, it's if you look at the list, there's, you know, Forrester, Cataldo, Little, Booten, Prescott, and Stiles. I mean, you're also talking about four Republicans who voted for Medicaid expansion there.
So four moderate Republicans.
Republicans. These are the moderate Republicans that are leaving. So it's going to be interesting to see what the makeup of the, particularly the Republican caucus is come next year. And of these six Republicans, probably the only really, really safe Republican seat is the one in 23 that Prescott is leaving. All the rest seem to be up in the air, and there's another couple of seats that are probably up in the air. So we could be looking at a very, very different Senate, one that could be democratically controlled, could be Republican controlled. But even if it's Republican controlled, it's going to be a very different breed of Republican that will be in there than what's there now.
Kathleen?
Yeah, I think Gary makes a great point. Nancy Stiles and Dave Booten and Jerry Little are all people that have, they vote with their party the majority of the time, but they are people that have, joined with the Democratic caucus on a variety of issues, whether it's last session Medicaid expansion, the gas tax. There were a few this session. I mean, on conversion therapy, you had Little and Prescott, were supportive of the ban. So as Gary mentioned, people that are, will cross party lines on occasion. And also, for the most part, I think people that were probably relatively easy for Senate President Chuck Morris to, to work with. So we'll see what happens with those seats. And obviously it's harder to hold an open seat, than it is when you have an incumbent. And as Gary mentioned, Molly Kelly and David Pierce, the Democrats who are retiring, Democrats are not, they're not going to have trouble keeping those seats. Whereas now there's six open races that are already in districts that could be swings. Jerry Little's district was already a little bit of a swing district. So there's Democrats see big opportunity. I mean, you walk around the state house halls and, you can – these Democratic senators, they are beaming. They are very excited. I think Jeff Woodburn, the Senate Democratic leader, is feeling very, very good the more retirements that he hears about from his Republican colleagues. They think they could win this back. Republicans have controlled the state Senate since 2010. So – I think the Democrats are hoping that there's potential here, but it's also, as we know, this has been a crazy and unpredictable election cycle. We know what the presidential ticket's going to look like. We don't know who the gubernatorial candidates are going to be. So there's a lot of unanswered questions, but Democrats are feeling good right now.
Well, speaking of the presidential cycle, and your note of caution is appreciated, Kathleen, because it has been a very unpredictable political year. But the National Republican Party, Dean Spiliotis, this week said, New Hampshire primary, we're not feeling the love for you right now. Now, this is not unusual. Every 4 years or 8 years, it seems like the National Republican or Democratic Party says New Hampshire needs to be reconsidered. What's happening this time around?
Yeah, as first in the nation, as I tweeted this morning, FITN, here we go again. Steve Dupree, RNC representative from New Hampshire, is going to be in the middle of it again. You know, you have these periodic challenges to the first in the nation status of New Hampshire as a primary, of Iowa as a caucus, this whole idea of carving out a couple of dates before the main primary schedule to let certain states go first. And it's part of a bigger discussion among Republicans about how to kind of regain control of the process. They thought that cutting back the number of debates this time would help a bit. Having some stricter penalties for noncompliance with RNC rules would help. But they ended up with Donald Trump. And so the concern is, you know, it's a whole range of issues. The New Hampshire component of this is there have been suggestions that either, you know, New Hampshire should no longer be the first primary, or as you mentioned, maybe pairing New Hampshire and the other early states with a neighboring state that doesn't normally go early. So New Hampshire and Massachusetts or New Hampshire and Maine.
Which made a lot of people, Dean, go,
yeah.
What?
Yeah, people were not thrilled about the idea. So, you know, this has been going on for a while. It came up at the winter meeting in January of the RNC, and it was sort of tabled. It came up again in the spring meeting, also didn't go anywhere. But now, as we go into the summer convention, it'll go to the Rules Committee, and then it'll go to the whole RNC, and then it'll go to the delegates on the floor of the convention. So there are still multiple opportunities to kind of preserve first in the nation status. Donald Trump came out, I believe, yesterday and said that if he's president, New Hampshire would keep its position. People appreciated that. But there is this larger discussion about, you know, should there be caucuses? Should you have open primaries? Should we, in New Hampshire, should we have primaries in New Hampshire where only Democrats and Republicans can vote? Those are the kinds of issues that I think the party is kicking around as a means to sort of exert greater control. The underlying problem, though, is that this stuff is all decided at the state level. So the RNC is kind of has imperfect control over the process, and it's this constant tension between what we do here, Bill Gardner, for example, the Secretary of State, and what the RNC decides nationally. So we're basically going through this cycle yet once again.
Well, it's a good point, Dean. And, you know, we've done a couple programs just in the last couple months looking at this system. Right. And because there have been so many complaints about it on both the Republican side and the Democratic side. So it does seem like there's a lot of outstanding concern. You know, caucuses, are they really fair? You know, you got to show up for 3-4 hours. If you're a waitress working the night shift, forget it. There's been some concern about that. Also, the idea of, you know, whether party primaries should just be for party folk. And on the Democratic side, the Bernie Sanders supporters have said, no, independents should be included. So it's very tricky.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if we had closed primaries here in New Hampshire. Very unlikely that either Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders would have won, or a lot less likely that they would have won their respective primaries.
And yet the parties keep tweaking the system every 4 or 8 years, and then something else happens, and they say,
They basically respond to the problem from the previous cycle.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. You're always fighting the last war. Yeah. Go ahead, Kathleen.
I always just find it fascinating to watch, you know, the RNC, the Republican Party in particular, talking about, you know, what kind of control they should exert when it's like Republicans are a states' rights party, right? And so to have, you know, states decide if they want independents to vote in their primaries and things like that seems to kind of go along with Republican orthodoxy. So I always think it's interesting, you know, to see when they want to exert a little bit more control.
Well, it's fascinating because you remember they came out, they did this kind of postmortem on the 2012 election, and the RNC said that the party needed a different kind of candidate and a different kind of set of constituencies. And what they're ending up with is really sort of the complete opposite of what they were pushing for in that study. So it shows you how difficult it is to actually control the process.
Well, this is probably a story we'll be following up on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup as the summer kicks into full gear, as the conventions begin and so forth. So we'll set it aside for now. I just want to mention briefly, all of you, a story out of the Gorham North Conway area that broke just yesterday, where after nearly 2 years of preparing for trial, a man accused of kidnapping and sexually assaulting a teenage girl for months decided to confess. Nathaniel Kibbe pled guilty yesterday and has been sentenced to 45 to 90 years in jail. He'll serve his sentence out of state. So I just wanted to give that update there because that's a story that, you know, we followed as it was emerging when the girl was freed many months ago. So there's that update. I want to turn now to a fish story, specifically of New Hampshire herring. With us now to help out is David Brooks. He's a reporter at the Concord Monitor, who also goes by the alias Granite Geek. David, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you bet.
Well, I'm going to show my lack of knowledge here. What's a herring?
A herring is one of, and also sometimes known as alewife. They're two related species. You know alewife from the tube stub down there by Boston. They are a foot-longish fish that has long been a major part of the ecosystem up here. And like salmon, they are one of the species that they give birth in freshwater, then swim down to the ocean where they grow up, mate, come back to freshwater to give birth. And so dams have been very bad for them. They have been doing very badly for many, many, many decades.
Because they just can't get back to their spawning places.
To their spawning place, exactly.
Right, right. So I saw something just, I think it was on WMUR TV this past week, where at that fish ladder on the Merrimack River in Manchester, you look in the little window there, and there's gazillions of fish. So
yes.
What's going on?
As I reported a couple days ago, this is the biggest run they've had in at least 20 years. So there's more than a third of a million fish have come back. So they come back upriver, and they actually hit a dam in Lawrence. That's the first dam up, and they have to be lifted over Lawrence by a little elevator, frankly.
So who does that? Sorry, there's a fish elevator in Lawrence?
Yeah, a fish elevator. It's called a lift, but it's really just an elevator. It's done by Fish and Wildlife, the Federal Fish and Wildlife. Here in New Hampshire, New Hampshire Fish and Game participates as well because they also want to have these fish returned to the river. Herring they're an important food source for almost everything from ospreys to bass. And if we can get them back into the ecosystem in large numbers, spawning, running up and down the river, that would be very good for everything.
So they'll feed other fish. They'll feed those big predator birds that we like to see.
Absolutely. And it's correct. If you go down to the Amescape Fishways, they have the observatory there at the dam in Manchester. It is really impressive right now. The number of fish going by is awesome. As I say, this is the most they've had since at least 1994. As recently as like 3 or 4 years ago, but in 2011, there were fewer than 1,000 herring came back up the river, which is, for all practical purposes, none. And there's, as I say, been a third of a million so far this season, and it's not over yet.
So it's pretty cool, not only for the fish themselves, but for all the creatures that rely on them. And if you've ever seen an eagle swoop down in the Merrimack River and grab a fish, as I have, it's pretty amazing to look at. So any idea, David, why so many? And by the way, it's really nice to have some good news to report.
It does have some good news to report. No, it's not clear why there's so many. And the irony, of course, is that we've been trying desperately to do this with salmon, which is, you know, the sexy fish that has the same kind of lifestyle. And 2 years ago, basically, we threw up our hands and the federal government said, forget it, it's not going to work. We can't bring salmon back to the Merrimack or the Connecticut rivers. They've abandoned efforts to do the same thing.
So maybe we can now. Is that
well,
the point?
Well, maybe, although the salmon numbers are not coming back at all. Salmon are even, they have even more complications they face than herring. It's not clear why. I mean, there's just a ton of problems with a life cycle that involves both freshwater and saltwater. It's complicated. There's lots of places where things can go wrong. The oceans are getting more acidic. They're warming up. There's a lot more predators. Bass are not good for the young anadromous fish in the river. There's a whole bunch of reasons why things have not been going well for a long time. Not just the dams. And people would like to say, hey, we've fixed it, and the herring are back. However, they have to point out 20 years ago, 1994, when they were more than a quarter of a million of them came back. A couple years later, the numbers crashed for reasons they didn't really understand at the time. We don't really know, so we can't guarantee that this is going to last. But it's hopeful, and it's a sign perhaps that things are getting better.
Well, if this trend continues, and as I understand from you, David, it's a big if.
Yeah.
What are some possible next steps that the state might consider?
Well, the big next step we'd like to do is to put so there is a fish ladder at Manchester, so the herring can actually go up past the dam by themselves. Unlike in Lawrence. And there's also a fish ladder on the dam in Lowell. So the next dam upriver is in Goffstown, and the one after that is in Concord at Garden Falls. It would be nice to have fish ladders on both of those so that fish could spontaneously go past the dams to spawning grounds all on their own. That would probably help. Right now they have to be pulled out. I had a whole bunch of photos in the paper about this process. Pulled out, stuck in a truck. The truck's driven, and they're dumped in. It's a real pain in the neck. It's expensive. It would be nice to have with fish ladders, the fish could do that themselves, and that would give them yet another fighting chance.
Yeah, you know, and just picturing what might be going through the fish's small brains, you know, I don't want to get in a truck, right? I want to swim up the river myself. But if there are no options, then the wildlife people put them in a truck and ship them to the next place.
1,000 gallons of water in the back of the truck, and then you stick a pipe on it and go shoot them out in a Northwood Lake is where we saw them. They go flying out through the air and land in the water, and hey, presto.
Right, but then how do they get back to the ocean? I mean, their whole biology is based on...
They can go back over the dams. They can go down over the dams, usually. They sometimes get chewed up by the turbines.
Ouch,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, ouch indeed.
Okay. Well, David, thank you very much.
You bet.
Good to talk to you.
Okay.
That's David Brooks, again, reporter for the Concord Monitor, who also goes by the name The Granite Geek, covering science and all things geeky around the Granite State. And all of you always like to end the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup by asking what you're going to be covering next week. So, Gary, I'll start with you. What are you going to be working on?
Well, it's the big day at the State House on Wednesday with the House and Senate are in to act on all these conference committee bills. So that will be the final meeting of the legislature until they come back to deal with vetoes. So
Wednesday is the day where they say, yes, we can work together on this. Here you go, Governor Hassan, or no, forget it, next time.
Generally speaking, they mostly pass what the people have negotiated, generally speaking. So most of this stuff that they've passed and they've agreed to will be going to the governor.
Kathleen, how about you?
Yeah, I'll be watching that as well. And the governor has started to get a handful of bills to her desk. Once they're on her desk, she has 5 days to decide if she wants to sign, veto, or let them pass without her signature. So in addition to some of the ones we've talked about, there are a handful that are already there. I believe there's some gun bills that are heading her way, because so-called constitutional carry, which we know she's going to veto, some voting rights bills. There's a bill that would provide money for body scanners in the state prisons. That was a little bit controversial.
Right.
So seeing how
that.
She acts on these bills will be tracking. And also, now that the legislative session is wrapping up, starting to look at these elections, the gubernatorial race in particular. I'm interested in digging in on that a little.
Right, and there'll be candidates filing.
Yes,
the
filing
State
period
House.
Is June 1st through June 10th.
Okay, so we'll have a lot to talk about who shows up to file and who doesn't. Dean, how about you?
Today at noon at the Barley House, we'll be doing Pints and Politics with Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Connolly. You can find links to my interviews with Colin Van Ostern and Governor Hassan on my website, NH Political Capital. And we're going to be talking to Republican candidates as well in the coming weeks. Also watching the First in the Nation schedule issues come up again.
Well, Pints and Politics. It sounds
yes,
like
indeed.
Fun, Dean. Good
come
luck with that
pint.
Today. Okay. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Remember, the conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org/exchange. Thanks for listening. I'm Laura Kanoy.